Let's return to Exodus chapter number 3 as we consider Moses coming into contact with God for the very first time in his life. Chapter 3, verse 1 says, "Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God." So we know that Moses escaped from Egypt, from the wrath of the Pharaoh, which I believe was Hatshepsut, right around 1496 BC. And he spends the next 40 years in Midian. Now, Midian seems to be the region east of the Gulf of Aqaba that was home to one of the sons of Abraham through his wife Keturah. We know that Abraham had other children other than Yitzhak or Isaac, and he gave instructions to all of those descendants to stay east of the Promised Land. So that makes good sense that Midian would have gone to the south and east of the Promised Land and began raising his family and then eventually his ethnic group in that area. And that's where historically we find them. So the mountain Horeb, the desert mountain, is located somewhere east of the Gulf of Aqaba. I think we can be reasonably certain of that. The traditional site in the southern tip of the Sinai Peninsula was being visited by Jewish pilgrims before the birth of Christianity, but Christianity itself, thanks to the efforts of Empress Helena, really solidified that area as being the site of Mount Sinai. But unfortunately, as I said, I just don't see that being reasonable since Midian is east of the Gulf of Aqaba. Why would Moses be taking his father-in-law's flock several hundred miles away from Midian to graze them? It just doesn't follow. So it's much more likely that one of the high mountains on the east side of the Gulf of Aqaba is this great mountain that will become the Mountain of God. It has become popular in recent years to point to Jabal al-Laz as the Mountain of God. There's been several books that I've looked at that have presented that, and quite a few presentations online. And I did believe that that was very possible, even likely, for some time. It's a few miles east of the Gulf of Aqaba. It's in the country of Saudi Arabia. And it looks as if the top of the mountain is burned. But I have come to the conclusion it's too far south to really fit the story that we have in the Exodus account. So I got to thinking, what about a high mountain north of Al-Laz? And I found out that the highest mountain in that area is a place called Jabal Ad-Dami. It's actually the highest mountain in the country of Jordan. And it's about 6,000 feet, and it is about, I think, 30 or so miles away from the port city of what used to be called Ezion Geber, but now is called Aqaba. And it has this huge flat wadi area to the north of it that would have presented itself as the perfect place for the Israelis to encamp for a year as they were meeting with God and building the tabernacle and getting prepared for their trip to the Promised Land. So I think it fits a lot better. I would be interested if some people would do some research into that, do some archaeological checking around that region to see if maybe they come across some things that would show that the Israelis might have been there. Just to the north of Jabal Ad-Dami is the Wadi Rum, which is a wilderness area that lots and lots and lots of tourists visit, as well as natives of Jordan, as a place to just camp out there in the flat areas of the Wadi and enjoy nature itself. So I just find it interesting that very close to the place I think might be the camping area for the Israelis at Mount Sinai, we've got modern peoples going there all the time and camping out and to enjoy the wonderful open sky overhead during their nights. All right, so let's get back to the text itself. Regardless of where it's located, we know that Moses was taking care of sheep near this mountain when he saw something strange. Now, we are immediately told what that was, thanks to Moses, because he knows how the story will turn out. So verse number 2 says, the angel or the messenger of He Who Is, and that's the divine name, we will have that explained to us in just a moment, appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. So Moses appears to be out there pretty much by himself, and he's looking around, keeping track of all the sheep, and he sees somewhere in the distance a bush that's on fire. Now, that by itself is not that big of a deal. Lightning strikes can cause fires and burn things up. But as he's watching it, he sees that this bush is not burning. It's not burning up and the fire going out. And that intrigues him. And so he decides to go closer to check it out. Verse 4. When He Who Is saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moshe, Moshe. And he said, here I am. So a voice speaks out of the fire, out of the glory. We know this is the Shekinah glory of God, the blazing light, shadowless light of God's presence. And so he hears the voice of God and says, yeah, that's me. I'm Moses. Verse 5, then he said, do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. I shared with you last time, I do not think that this was considered a holy site previous to this event. If it had been, then Moses may have assumed from the very beginning that what he was sawing was supernatural, and he might have avoided it because of that. But he doesn't seem to attach any type of supernatural thinking to this burning fire. But when he does come near, God tells him, you are in a special place right now. Now, what will make it special is because he's going to tell Moses, bring the people of Israel back to this place so that I can make a covenant with them and then lead them into the Promised Land in accordance with my promises. So the removing of the sandals makes perfect sense in that man-made materials should not come between a person and God. In this sense, the place where God is at in this moment is this piece of property. So he should not have any type of man-made product on his feet to stop him, the created one, from coming into connection with the land of the Creator. It's the same thinking that's involved with men not wearing head coverings on their head whenever they are praying to God, as the scripture teaches, and which was the common Jewish practice until after the temple was destroyed. The reason modern-day Jews wear those coverings on their head is because that is a form of mourning, to cover the head. And so they are still mourning the loss of the temple. Previous to the loss of the temple in AD 70, Jewish men did not wear anything man-made on their head when they spoke to their Creator, so that it was a direct connection. And so that's the reason he's told to take the sandals off. And then God introduces himself. Verse 6, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Yitzhak, the God of Jacob. So he introduces the big three as being the ones that he, Moses, would understand having him, God, as their God. Abraham was the first one that was called to monotheism while he was in Ur of the Chaldees. Yitzhak embraced God as his own God as well. And then Jacob, over time, eventually came to that same conclusion that he would be the follower of the God of his fathers. So Moses is now being given the opportunity to embrace the same God as his own God. Moshe hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. He's never had this experience before. His parents knew that there was something special about him and probably taught him all the stories about Abraham and Yitzhak and Jacob, but he has never been talked to by God or had God's visible presence appear between him before. So he is terrified, and he is down on his face with his eyes covered. Then he who is said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land to a good land and a broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey. That's an idiom for very prosperous. If you've got lots of animals, that would be animals that produce milk, eating and producing lots of milk, that's a land of milk. And honey is not just simply about bees, it's also about agriculture. Bees are pollinators, and they help grow the crops. And some of those crops also produce sweet stuff, such as date palms. Those date palms, the juices of those dates are sometimes referred to as honey. So the land of flowing with milk and honey is a very prosperous land. It's the land of Canaan. To the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Now, those are all kind of tied together as to the variety of peoples living in the land of Canaan, the land of promise. When we zoom in on one of them in particular, it would be the Jebusites. The Jebusites are living in what will be called Jerusalem. And so that's important for the later stories. And so God makes sure that there's a focus on that particular subgroup of Canaanites. Now behold, God continues, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Now Moses has been gone for 40 years. It was in his heart 40 years ago to help his people out, to help the Israelis out, to free them from this bondage, to get them out of this horrible situation of being ethnic slaves. Because the pureblood Egyptians were keeping them as breeding stock slaves, as non-pureblood Egyptians, as Israelis, to do whatever it is they want them to do. It was very close to the situation that we had in the Western world, and I'm thinking particularly about here in the United States, during the era of slavery, when peoples were kept and bred simply because of their ethnicity to work as if they were draft animals. And it was never appropriate. It was totally a sinful practice, and it was a good thing to have been gotten rid of. It's too bad our founding fathers did not take it as seriously as they should have at the founding of our nation, and it ended up becoming an even bigger problem by the time it was resolved during the Civil War. But back to the Israeli situation, God is telling Moses, what you were hoping to do 40 years ago, I want you to do now. That's a bit of a problem because Moses has mentally moved on. And that comes up in his response. Because here he is, he's talking to the Creator God. The angel of the Lord, the visible presence of God's messenger is right there in the bush, shining and burning, and there's no fire eating up the bush, so it's clearly supernatural. And God is saying through this messenger, I've got a job for you, Moses. Go to Egypt. And Moses' response is this, verse 11. Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? So his first response is, why would you think I'm the guy? That was 40 years ago. I'm just a shepherd now. I've got a new life. Verse 12, he said, but I will be with you, and this will be the sign for you that I have sent you, that when you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. So God says, no, Moses, I need you to go and do this. And I guarantee you will be bringing all of those people back to this exact spot. And you will be offering sacrifices and doing worship ceremonies with all of those people right here. That's how you'll know I am the God who is. Verse 13, Moses is still not done objecting. Moses said to God, well, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, well, what's his name? What shall I say to them? Something has happened in the last 430 years of the Israelis being in Egypt. They've had the stories about Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, and the God who appeared to them and spoke to them and promised them all sorts of things. But that's all stories now. That's four generations, four very long generations, 430 years ago types of stories. And the Israelis have started adding back in many other gods and goddesses, similar to what Abraham had before he became the monotheist, the believer in the one true God. And so Moses is saying, well, if I go to them and say the God of our forefathers is sending me to them, they're going to want to know which one you are. You know, what's your name? Which part of the pantheon am I supposed to tell them? Because the Israelis, for the most part, seem to become polytheists again during this time. And this is where we are introduced officially to the divine name. Now, Moses, in writing this story down, and in writing the book of Genesis down, has already been using the divine name because he's writing those things after this event. Now we find out the significance of that name. Verse 14, God said to Moses, I am who I am. And then he said, say this to the people of Israel, that I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, he who is the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Yitzhak, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. Now, this is where I think something in my chronological companion notes could come in handy for you. And that is on page number 12, under a heading of chart number 5, Yahweh, the covenant name of God. I give an explanation of how this divine name of God came into existence at this point in the story, and how it kind of mutated over time so that the Israelites didn't even use the name anymore. And even we, in our modern time, tend not to actually verbalize the name. So when Moses asked, which God am I supposed to tell the Israelites? God's response is, I am whom I am. Meaning, I'm just God. That's it. That's really all that needs to be understood. See, the reason you need names for things and people is because there's more than one of them. But there really isn't more than one God. There is the one and true and living God, the creator of the universe. Every other so-called God is either a wannabe, Satan and his crew that rebelled against God, they're a bunch of wannabes, or they are figments of human imagination. They are not truly God. So God's response is basically, why should I need a name? I'm the only one in this category. However, he then goes on, so I suppose you could tell them that the I Am sent you to them, the one who needs no name, the one who's always been and always will be. However, to use that phrase, I Am, as the name of God is not workable. For example, let's just do this practical exercise. If I were to be a believer, which I am, asked by a non-believer, who is your God? For me to answer, I am, is not helpful because it sounds like I think I'm my own God. But if you change the person of the verb, meaning you go from the first person to the third person, he is, then it makes sense, or it can make sense much better. Let's ask the same question again. Who is your God? He who is. And that represents, of course, the one who is always in existence, the one who was, is, and will always be, which is another way that the scripture handles the idea of God. So what happens here in the text is that God says, I am the only God. However, you Israelis are going to refer to me as he who is. That's where the divine name comes in. And the way that Hebrew expressed he who is at this time, the best understanding of the pronunciation is Yahweh. It was four consonants representing our English letters YHWH. But immediately the problem started happening, and that is that by the time we get to the New Testament, the Israelis, through a very strict understanding of Exodus chapter 20, verse 7, don't use the name of the Lord your God in vain, they quit using or verbalizing Yahweh. They quit saying He who is. Instead, they substituted the phrase, or it's a single word in their language, My Lord, Adonai. During the Masoretic period, that's the AD 700s, some Hebrew scribes called Masoretes, they were living in Europe at the time, they decided it was time for their written language, Hebrew, to have vowel markings, which they hadn't had up to that point. When they looked at the consonants of their language, they just automatically knew which vowel sounds to put in because of long practice. So these guys started using vowel pointing, which we still see in modern Hebrew. Well, not modern, but printed biblical Hebrew. Well, to remind Jewish people, don't say the divine name, say Adonai, they took the vowel markings for Adonai and put them with the four consonants of the divine name, the YHWH. And unfortunately, that caused a problem when non-Jewish Europeans started studying written Hebrew during the explosion of Bible study in the 12s, 13, 14, 1500s. And so that's where we're going to go next time in the story of the divine name when we're back into the Word.